Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Life is indeed fascinating. I've always been fascinated by science and knowledge and what exactly exists out there. When I was young, I was very fascinated by space. Space and astronomy fascinated me endlessly. Added to that, all the weird stories of UFOs and aliens, it all just added to a real mystery, and it fascinated me. But even now, though I no longer worry about aliens and flying saucers, I still find life and space and everything above the Earth, below the Earth, and on the Earth fascinating. And there are topics that I want to return to later, topics that are really important, to do with whites, whites as a group, whites as a species. What is our future? What did nature intend our future to be? Or what could our future be if we carried on as we are? Currently, everybody thinks that whites are dead, that there is no future, etc. But the more I look at things and the more I study life, the more I think the future can be incredible, and that anybody who tells you there's no future doesn't know what he's talking about. And one thing that I find myself pondering endlessly these days is the marvelous nature of ourselves as biological entities. In fact, when I sit and think to myself quietly, I think of us as biological robots. That might freak you out, biological robots, because in many ways, that is actually how life is. And people will say, that is a freaky thought, but I need to discuss that more at length. It doesn't cease to amaze me that in our biological bodies that we have this consciousness, the ability to think, the ability to do many amazing things. The depth of our minds is truly incredible. The more I find out about life and the more I appreciate life, the more incredible life appears to me to be. That life is truly amazing. And even if there is no afterlife or anything else, the life that we have and the world that does exist, that we can see and touch, is almost beyond imagination in its sophistication and its complexity. So I no longer ponder whether there is an afterlife because I no longer believe in those things. But in this video, we're going to take a look at things from a little bit of a religious perspective. We're going to look at things the way that Christians and those religious types would want to see the world. And I too used to ponder God and the nature of God and what God must be. And for me, the only thing that seemed to make any sense was that if God existed, that God obviously did not just create the earth. God created the entire universe. So let us ponder that, the Christian notion that God created the heavens and the earth and everything in it, including ourselves. And what I want to discuss today is, what can we learn from God's creation? If you observe God's creation, what do you see in it? Now, most of the time, people look at God's creation and they say it's beautiful. In our eyes, it can be very beautiful. We look at the plants and the natural life, and it's very lovely. And we can look at the birds and all the other animals, and we can say, man, that's amazing. And one can look at the herbivores and the animals that eat plants and the fish in the sea, and we can say, yeah, that's very cool stuff. Very nice, even tranquil. And then you get a line of thinking that says that humans, and normally whenever it's humans, it's of course whites, then they say, well, God created a wonderful earth, and it's truly fantastic. And then humans, in brackets, read whites, came and screwed it all up. That humans came and stuffed it all up, and man is fallible and man is stupid. Man, of course, in each case being the white man. Man is fallible, man is stupid, man is idiotic, but God is perfect and nature is perfect. And we should abandon all these things that we've created, and instead we must revert to nature so that things can be perfect again. And nowadays, I really resent it when man, especially white man, is constantly singled out as the problem. And so many whites view this as the correct view of life, that God is perfect, nature is perfect, man is to blame for everything that is wrong. And it's always the white man, and it's always civilization, and it's always progress. These are the things that are to be blamed. Nobody ever turns around and says, but hold on, what about the black man? What about the savage who lives in the jungle? Maybe he's to blame for some things. Maybe there's something wrong with him. And you won't get that. Instead, the savage who lives in the jungle, he is the noble savage. He's always good because he's in tune with nature. Or so they say. But now that I'm older and wiser, I tell you, I look at things and I don't see these things as being true. And I no longer buy into the notion that the only faulty person around is the white man. In fact, I have a bunch of things to say about the white man and the race as a whole. Suffice it to say that I have similar views to Ben Klassen, the founder of the religion called creativity, and the man who wrote the book called The White Man's Bible. Ben Klassen had some revolutionary ideas about whites, and I think that his thoughts will stand the test of time. But let's take a closer look at nature and just see a few things about nature, and I want to show you some film footage of nature in action and see what we can deduce about some aspects of nature. We are used to seeing birds flying around, and birds, by their nature, are definitely an incredible thing of nature. To be able to fly, and to be able to not only physically fly, but have a body that is efficient enough that it can derive energy from eating and have enough energy as well as the correct design in order to fly around. This is all downright amazing. The true incredible nature of life and animals lies in the art of precision. Now, precision is a topic I'm going to come back to as well for whites, because it's a very important part of our survival mechanism. But just to show you precision in another form, and just one of many examples of nature being incredible, take a look at this little bit of film footage from France. Here's an animal called the ibex, and the ibex needs to get certain salts. And the only way the ibex can get it is by climbing up on the side of a dam wall. And when you look at the film footage, it should become apparent that what you've got here is an animal that, although it can't fly, it is actually doing something just as dangerous, maybe even more dangerous than a bird, because at least a bird has got wings and it can control its descent if something goes wrong. But the ibex can't. So for the ibex, if the ibex makes the slightest mistake, the ibex will tumble down and die. And just take a close look at the ibex, even a mother and its baby, and just marvel at how it can climb to heights beyond all imagination, and it can do so where the slightest mistake will result in its death, just in the same way that a mountain climber can die through a single mistake. This is the nature of some of life, that if you make a mistake, life never forgives. Nature does not forgive. And I think in the things that you're about to see, you will notice that is one lesson out of nature. One lesson that flies in the face of what you are taught from the Bible. And that is that forgiveness is not natural. Nature does not forgive. Christians who read their Bible look on forgiveness as a good thing. But in reality, forgiveness is an unnatural thing, and nature does not forgive. If you make mistakes, nature can just go and kill you outright. If you were to try and walk off a cliff and say, well, I've lived a good life, and maybe nature will be soft on me. The fact is, nature won't be soft on you. If you walk off the cliff, you will die like anything else that goes over that cliff. And in this film footage, you'll see the ibex. The ibex, too, is in the same situation. If it makes a mistake, it will die, and that will be the end of it. And there will be no forgiveness for the ibex. And that is the way nature is. So take a look at this film footage and you'll see the amazing ibex. And ponder how the brain of this animal, the body of this animal, its brain to body coordination has to be unbelievably accurate, or else this animal will die. It will die in an instant.
The rock that was used to build this dam contains essential minerals that have been dissolved in water. Minerals rich in the calcium that these animals need to stay strong. And they'll scale a dam to get them.
In una situazione estrema, diciamo così, di rapidità, la possibilità di recare del sale è una tentazione fortissima.
Without these salts and minerals, their bones won't grow, their nervous systems and muscles can't function. Movement and coordination can falter.
Io ho abbastanza paura quando sono in situazioni molto ripide e guardo verso il basso, non sono di certo uno stambecco.
There's a strong bond between mother and kid, and the kid will follow her wherever she goes. The ibex eventually make it to the prize. Salt from the earth, dissolved in water, continues on its journey into their bodies. Where it's used in the nerves and muscles that control dexterous pincer-like hooves. Vital ingredients, carried around by a simple molecule with remarkable properties.
In this piece of film footage that you're going to see, this film footage comes from South Africa. And this film footage was filmed by whites in South Africa. And I'll bet you that all the people who filmed this, because you'll see this is composed of film footage that comes from two different vehicles, I'll bet you that all the people involved in watching this and filming this were Christians. And you can hear some of them speaking in Afrikaans. So what you're about to see is nature in action in South Africa, most likely at the Kruger National Park. And the Kruger National Park was a creation of Paul Kruger, the leader of the Boers in the South African Republic, before the British came and conquered them. In order to steal their gold at the behest of the Rothschilds, the Jewish Rothschilds. Now here in South Africa, the whites, including the Christian whites, all have a respect for nature, and you will see that in this film footage. So even the Christians do not mess with nature, and they accept the rules and laws of nature the way that nature is, and you will see it in evidence in this film footage. In this film footage, you're going to see people driving in cars and vehicles on a road in the game park. And you will see that they respect nature and that there's a lion. And this male lion is walking in the road. And all these people are respecting the lion. They could kill the lion. They could drive over the lion. They could shoot the lion. But they respect the lion. And what the lion then goes on to do, as much as it astounds and even shocks the whites, they respect the lion. They accept that the lion's behavior is normal and natural. So what happens is the lion is walking along, and then some of these whites realize, as you'll hear in their conversation, that there's a kudu off to the side of the road, and the lion is walking, and then the lion spots the kudu, and the lion dashes off, and it starts grabbing onto the kudu, and the lion starts sinking its teeth and its claws into the kudu, to the amazement and shock of the people there. And there's a woman who keeps saying, "Holy, holy, holy," and then she says, "Holy smokes." I think she wanted to say, "Holy shit, holy shit." I think that's what she really wanted to say. But anyway, the lion grabs hold of this kudu and eventually manages to bring the kudu down. And it's been doing a little bit of munching, and there's a slight bit of blood on its snout. And some of these people say that the kudu is dead, but it's actually not dead. If you look carefully, especially towards the end of the film footage, you'll see that the kudu may be lying on its side, but it's breathing. It's breathing quite intensely. But the kudu has given up on the idea of resisting the lion. The lion has used its force to overcome the kudu, and so it's merely a matter of time before the lion resumes munching on the kudu. But the kudu is alive. So when the lion munches on the kudu, there is no anesthetic There is nothing. It's the lion munching on a live creature. So here are these Christian whites in South Africa who respect nature. And by the way, a lot of these Christians are also hunters. There are many in South Africa who hunt. So they don't have a problem with animals being killed by animals or people killing animals. They accept that death is part of life. They accept that things have to die. And as long as the things that are dying are animals and not humans, they accept it quite happily. They don't see any contradiction between that and God or the Bible. That this is the nature of life, that life includes death and cruelty. So watch this lovely piece of film footage. It's quite amazing stuff, really. And look at what the lion does. And also, none of these white Christians are in any way messing with nature. They accept that this is nature. This is the world that, if God created the world, then this is the world that he created. And whatever reasons he had for creating it and creating the things within it, he saw this as good. And this is what we're going to ponder some more of in this video. So take a look at this.
Oh, there's a kudu right here. Oh my word.
Babe, there's a kudu right here.
You see him coming, baby?
Yeah.
Love, you're going to have to get off your phone.
What?
Because you're going to have to drive.
I know, I'm going to go that way, so they can't just won't drive.
Well, they're all going to just reverse into you.
I'm not going to go. Look, he's going for the kudu.
Holy, 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 holy smokes. He's gonna get him.
Bye-bye.
Oh, sorry, baby. Mommy's, it's not bad.
Stop, Leafy. Stop. Come with me.
Neem verder. It's a kill.
In the next piece of film footage, we're going to take a look at the sea, the fish and animals in the sea. You've seen the cruelty of the lion, and of course there are lots of other animals like the lion, packs of dogs, hyenas, other big cats, all kinds of other predators, snakes, you name it. But the main point in viewing that was to just show you the lion, a normal animal, and what the lion does in order to get food. And in order to get food, he has specific kinds of foods that he needs to eat. And they're living creatures. Now, nature doesn't waste. That's the next thing. If nature, on the one hand, doesn't forgive, or if it forgives, it's either very rare or totally accidental. But in the case of food, you'll see that nature does not waste anything. Nature is full of recycling and reusability. In fact, nature is highly efficient in this sense. There is no wastage. And another thing about nature is that it isn't a case that everybody gets along, that everybody wins together. In nature, there are winners and there are losers. The winner, if he's out to get a meal, the winner gets a full stomach. The loser gets death. The winner doesn't go to heaven. The winner merely gets he gets a much more limited reward. The winner gets enough to live from until he's hungry again. Then he's got to go through the whole process again. The loser, on the other hand, gets death. It's that simple. So not only does nature not forgive, nature's also highly efficient, and the loser gets to die. One thing that has been apparent to me for a long time is the sheer efficiency of nature, in that everything in nature is eaten by something else. Whether it is a plant that's eaten by a herbivore, or whether it's a live animal that's eaten by another animal, or whether it's an animal that dies and the ants and worms get to eat it, along with maybe the vultures and the hyenas. But everything is going to be eaten. And you yourself, the day you are buried, you will be eaten by the worms. Nature is thus very efficient. And I suspect that it's a design thing. I suspect that efficiency is a necessity for nature, actually. My suspicion is that when you have an animal, let's say a herbivore, that eats grass and turns the grass into meat, that the meat now having protein, etc., all that processing that went into creating the flesh and the bone, that this now makes that animal a higher form of food. So the irony of biological life is that in order to keep yourself alive, you automatically also become a meal for something else, that there is a whole disposal mechanism waiting for you. And so nature's got forms of life that immediately target, let's call it, higher forms of food. And that's where things like the lions and all the other parasites come into it. They target the living animal. And the beauty of decomposition and the ability for anything to feed anything else, it's a highly efficient system. That which is not eaten by other animals decomposes and goes into the soil and feeds the plants. There is just no wastage. The system is so efficient. And it's a system that is reusable. Everything is recyclable. So if God created anything, he not only created life, but he created a recycling system that exists. And everything will be recycled, including you. There is somebody who said that we are made of stardust, and that's correct, because at the end of the day, when you study science and astronomy, you'll realize that everything that exists ultimately are the remains of what once were stars. So ultimately, even the planet itself, life itself, ultimately is really nothing more than stardust. And the stardust may be turned into life, but the stardust itself will be recycled and the life will again become dust. However, the mystery for me and the fascinating part for me is that this dust can attain consciousness, reasoning capabilities, and it can do things. And that is what we are. We're a form of life. But I'll discuss more about whites as a form of life later. We'll return to that topic. We ourselves are part of the biology of the planet. Now, in the case of the lion, there are times where the lion might not get enough food. And I once watched a video where I think it was a cheetah, a female cheetah that was ill and starving, and the cheetah needed to hunt in order to get the food that would allow it to live. And if the cheetah couldn't kill, then the cheetah itself was going to die of starvation and weakness. And I can't quite remember whether the cheetah succeeded or whether it died in the end. But for the animal that lives off other animals, that animal only has the choice of either succeed and kill your food or you will die. The lion cannot go and start munching on bananas. The lion can only eat meat. So the requirements are quite firm and fixed. And the lion gets to live as long as he can eat. And in order to eat, he has to kill. So for as long as he can kill, he can live. The moment that he is incapable of killing, that's when the end has come for him. The system is efficient. And another thing about the system is that pain and suffering is part of the system. And there is no forgiveness for pain and suffering. Pain and suffering itself and the cruelty of the whole process is quite fascinating, and it provides motivations for living, because the cruelty and the pain is itself a thing that forces the animal to be on the lookout for enemies. If you look at these animals, you'll find that animals are quite jumpy, that the animals become afraid and they're on the lookout for something that might come to munch them. These are the animals that are, let's say, the victim animals. They are quite jumpy about these things because they don't want to die. And what exactly it is that motivates them, whether it is pain or just the fear of pain and death combined, that makes them jumpy, but they are conscious of the need to stay one step ahead of the animal that wants to eat them. And if you observe nature closely, you'll see that animals are quite paranoid, actually, because they have to keep an eye open. They know they can be munched on by something, and they don't want that to happen to them. And also, when something comes to munch on them, the fastest and fleetest among them dashes off. It's every man for himself. And they dash off and they go and they escape. And the ones that aren't so fleet-footed, they're the ones that become the meal. In the next video, it's actually two videos that I put together, you're going to take a look at the sea. And the sea can be quite heavily populated with animals. And in the sea, there are some pretty nasty, aggressive animals. And you'll see that aggression and the ability to kill and eat is very important in the sea. And in the sea, it's interesting that you'll find animals where you get two carnivores that eat each other. So either carnivore A eats carnivore B, or sometimes carnivore B eats carnivore A. So you have two carnivores, and whichever one manages to nab the other one, he wins, and he gets to live. So in the sea, it's not just, let's call it the herbivore victim type animals that get eaten. It's carnivores even eating carnivores. And in this case, you're going to see the eel, the moray eel. It's actually an aggressive carnivore. And you'll see a moray eel fighting a shark, fighting an octopus. You'll see that sometimes the one wins, sometimes it loses. You'll see an eel trying to swallow a shark and then coughing out the shark. Then you'll see an octopus eating an eel bit by bit. It's a nasty business. If land life is cruel and life in the air is cruel, man oh man, life in the sea is even more brutal. Life in the sea is quite horrific, actually. And you'll see these animals busy munching on each other or trying to munch on each other. And the determination to get that meal and to live. And of course, they have to get the meal because the biological body needs food. It needs some kind of protein that it can get in and process for energy. So because of its energy needs, it's got to feed itself. And that's an interesting twist in life itself, is that you cannot in this world sit around and just wait. Nature gives you energy, but you only get your energy from food. And no matter how much you try to sit around and do nothing and use as little as possible, your body needs its fuel. You could say your body needs its petrol, and you will need it. And no matter how little you use, you will need fuel. And at a point, you have to obtain that fuel. And in that sense, life itself pushes everybody forward. It pushes everyone so that there comes a time where you must have a meal. You must eat something. And whatever process you use to obtain that food, you must do it or you will die. And in that sense, it puts a pressure on all living things, including humans. It puts pressure on us and all other animals. You cannot sit around doing nothing. At some point, you have to use some kind of effort to obtain your fuel, because if you don't, you will die. And that pushes individuals and groups into a situation of doing something. They cannot just sit around. And when it pushes you into doing something, that in and of itself can later become a group thing, where the entire group has to go and obtain fuel for itself. And if it doesn't do it, then the group's survival is at threat. And it can then result in one group clashing with another group because whoever has the fuel gets to live and survive. In that sense, life actually pushes us into conflict. It pushes those animals into conflict. Those animals cannot sit around doing nothing. They have to eat at some point. And if eating means it's got to eat another live animal, then it does that. And that may bring it into direct conflict with that other animal. But the same is true for humans. It's just a much more sophisticated process, but it's true for humans. And it becomes true for nations, and it's true for races. But life pushes you into certain types of conflict. You cannot sit around and say, oh well, I'm not going to get involved in any conflict in life at all because that is against my principles. You will at a point in time need food, shelter, clothing, and those things. And if you cannot obtain it in one way, you will obtain it in another way. But observe nature at sea. And look at these animals. Look at how determined and energetic they are. They are using every ounce of energy in order to live. Every ounce of energy. Some of the battles are so intense and so vicious. And it's a case of either it wins or it loses. Winning and losing are two opposite things. And losing either leads directly to death or it leads you closer to death. But there are winners and there are losers. And it's a very clear-cut thing. It's brutal and it's cruel. And I even feel sorry for the eel right at the end that loses to the octopus, and the eel gets eaten slowly, and the eel is obviously in pain and discomfort, but eventually it too gives up the fight and just waits to die. But that is how these animals are functioning. And these animals are higher level creatures than plants, etc. They've got the ability to move, to think, to act, and look at them. They are vicious and brutal. And cruelty, nobody cares about cruelty. Cruelty is just a part of life. And it's too bad if you're on the receiving end. If you're the loser, you will experience pain. You will experience the nastiness of a cruel death. But there's no forgiveness. The one animal doesn't go and give the other animal a pill or an anesthetic to reduce its pain. It just sinks its teeth into the animal and moves on. It's a brutal world. Pain is what the loser experiences. Being on the receiving end of cruelty is what the loser experiences. The winner has to use all his energy in order to win. And like I say, his reward isn't that great. His reward is a full stomach and the ability to live a while until he's hungry again, in which case he has to repeat his performance. Another point that is worth making is that in nature, there are also limitations. There isn't an unlimited amount of things. So you have to go and eat and get what you can from what nature provides. And if you bring this back to communism and liberalism and Jews, you'll find that those idiots, morons and liars, you'll see that they often like to talk as if there is unlimited amount of resources, which in reality there isn't. There is a limit to how much there is in terms of resources. And in nature, the animals have to get the meal that they can get. And you'll see the animals don't muck around. When they can get a meal, they grab it. But if you listen to liberals, Jews, and communists, you'd think that there is unlimited amounts of everything. Money, products, everything. Which is junk. It's total rubbish. There isn't an unlimited amount of things. And now let me shock you with something that I've realized in recent months. And we're going to talk about it in more depth. But I'm going to give you the basic input here. And that is that parasitism is the norm. That among all animals and all forms of life, being a parasite is the norm. If you look at the definition of parasite in the dictionary, it says an organism that lives in or on a different kind of organism called the host, from which it gets some or all of its nourishment. Parasites are generally harmful to their hosts, and in some cases they may even destroy the other organism, although more often the damage they do is minor. Lice and tapeworms are parasites of humans. But what I will explain to you is that in human culture, when we get to the topic of Professor Carol Quigley, that in human culture, humans are mostly parasites. In fact, in all cases, except for Western civilization, all humans are parasites. Now, the definition for parasite that Quigley used was humans who go and obtain their nourishment and their requirements by taking from nature. But if you apply that definition to animals, then all animals are parasites. All of them. The cow is a parasite because the cow eats grass. In other words, Quigley's definition that he used for humans, if you take his definition and apply it to animals, then it turns out that all of nature is parasitic, all of it. Because there is no animal that actually produces what it needs. Every animal is eating something else that's provided by another part of nature. And in that sense, whites are then the only animal that exists that is not parasitic, because whites create everything they need through farming, etc. Whites create more than they need, and that is unique. That is totally unique. It's unique in the animal kingdom, and it's unique among humans. And that is a topic that we'll get to later. But notice nature, and notice all these animals are dependent on things that come from other parts of nature. And cruelty is just part and parcel of the process. Nature may use pain as a method of scaring an animal so that it looks after itself, but it doesn't save it from experiencing pain. In that sense, nature's totally ruthless. Whatever must happen regardless of the pain. There is just no forgiveness, nothing to make life more pleasant for the loser. The loser just gets a nasty, nasty deal. Nature does not forgive losers. Nature does not make life easier for losers. Losers get pain and suffering, and that's that. And nature moves on. So nature does not waste time on any kind of emotion or anything. So here's the film footage of the animals in the sea, and check out how brutal it is. Really brutal. And this is the world that God made, and that world is built on efficiency.
Hi there. Today we will tell you about moray eels, and also look at what they are capable of in battles with other marine inhabitants. Moray eels belong to the family of eels, and is widely known for its unusual appearance and aggressive behavior. This eel is a predator and has many features similar to snakes. For example, a powerful serpentine body allows them to not only conveniently move in the water, but also hide in narrow burrows and crevices of rocks. Their appearance is quite frightening. A huge mouth and small eyes, the body is slightly flattened on the sides. Although moray eels are similar to snakes, they are not at all friendly with them. Look at how the snake, in its unusual manner, tries to swallow the moray eel whole. It had already swallowed a third of the moray eel, but something had gone wrong. Apparently, the moray eel turned out to be too long, and the sea snake began to burp it out. This moray eel was lucky. It remained alive. But this one cannot be envied. During a long struggle, inch by inch, a sea snake swallows its prey. After some time, the moray eel disappears in the bottomless mouth of the snake, and this time, it is not going to spit it out. True, if the snake met here with this type of moray, then everything would be the other way around. This is a giant moray eel, the largest species of moray eels. It can grow up to 10 feet in length, and a sea snake is only a little over 3 feet long. But even such a giant moray eel prefers to avoid open water and usually hides in shelters at a depth of no more than 160 feet. The weight reaches 70 pounds. The laterally compressed body that is covered with mucus provides easy penetration of moray eels into caves and other natural shelters and helps protect against mechanical damages and water parasites. The head, along with the entire upper body and the fins, is a yellow-brown in color
and is heavily strewn with various sizes of dark spots. So the body and the color of moray eels strongly resembles that of leopards. Such huge moray eels hunt alone and only at night. And these giant creatures even mess with sharks. And here is an amazing video of such an attack. The moray eel ambushed the shark and tightly clutched its tail. The shark, of course, made attempts to break free, but all in vain. Then the moray eel makes a tricky move. To prevent the shark from escaping, it pinches it with rotation, and from the tail to the shark's head, it slowly begins to swallow it whole. Just imagine for a second that there is a monster in the sea that can actually swallow a shark whole. Of course, the shark is small, but still, facts are facts. The shark, of course, is a real fighter and fights for its life to the end. It manages to get out and is slightly dumbfounded and swam away. And in this video, it's the other way around. The moray eel is resting without harming anyone in the recess at the bottom. And then out of nowhere, a shark appeared and attacked it. Just then, the moray eel did not want to give up and bit the shark several times. But because of the shark's clear superiority in size, it could not win this fight and was eventually eaten. A moray eel eats almost any large or small fish, as well as representatives of the family of crustaceans and cephalopods. It easily swallows small fish whole, but larger prey is driven into crevices in reefs and torn into pieces there. And here is a vivid example of this. The moray eel is attacking an octopus and begins to bite it and tear it to pieces. The fate of such an octopus is sad, but such is nature. However, we all know that the octopus can secrete a caustic ink liquid for self-defense. Watch how this moray eel begins to tear this octopus again. However, he is not timid and releases the same liquid, which has a paralyzing effect on the olfactory organs of the predator. The moray eel, having experienced its effects, loses its sense of smell for more than an hour. And for example, a fish, such as a tetraodon, learned how to scare away predators. Moray eels, as always, waits for an ambush. The tetraodon inadvertently swam too close, and the moray eel attacks. Fish caught in the treacherous jaws of a predator. But look what happens. The pufferfish swells, increasing its size by 2 times. Moray eels make vain attempts to clutch, but its mouth cannot stretch so much, and the fish calmly swims away. To deal with prey, moray eels are helped by 2 pairs of jaws equipped with huge and sharp teeth. The first pair of jaws is the main one, and it is located like all other fish, but the second one is in the pharynx and is called the pharyngeal jaw. When the moray eel is to hunt, the pharyngeal jaw is deep, but when approaching the prey, it immediately extends close to the main one, creating a double trap for the victim. The main function of the hind jaws is to chomp food and push it into the esophagus. Eyewitnesses filmed an amazing event in shallow water. At first, they saw the squid and were surprised why it was near the coast, but soon everything became clear. The squid was just looking for salvation from the bloodthirsty moray eels that haunted him. But nevertheless, it was overtaken, and they began to tear and nibble on the tentacles. Then the second predator sailed. Of course, it was very bad for the poor squid, but such is nature. Someone is the predator, and someone else is the prey. And in this video, two Moray Ills mated to death. One of them is slightly larger and more powerful than its opponent, and this apparently served as the reason for its victory. Just look, it bit the opponent in half. But the second Moray Ill fights to the last and bites behind the head of their offender. But the forces leave her body. The battle is lost. The interaction of Moray Ills with the other predator inhabitants of the underwater world is also very interesting. For example, such as Sebastus. Usually, each of them goes hunting alone. Moray Ills prefer to attack at night from an ambush, and Sebast in the daytime on open water taking refuge in corals. However, some Moray Ills living in the Red Sea go hunting in the afternoon, and even pair with Sebast, who usually initiates this hunt. This happens when the prey is too far away or takes refuge next to the Moray Ill shelter. First, the perch swims to the Moray Ill, and if it sees the head of the mistress outward, it leads its head to the sides in front of her nose. This is a kind of invitation to a joint hunt. If the predator agrees, Sebast accompanies her to the victim and shakes her head, indicating the direction. The Moray Ill is not difficult to slip inside and catch it. Then the Moray Ill gives food to its companion. Here is such an amazing fish from the Ill family, and its apprentice fully reflects its character. This is a real predator, aggressive and very dexterous, dodgy, which, thanks to its serpentine body, is able to get a victim from anywhere. And that's all for today. We hope you are interested and learned a little something new for yourself. And don't forget to put like if you like this video. Thanks for watching. Subscribe for more.
Now that you've seen the cruelty of life at sea, let me show you some other creepy stuff that God obviously thought up that is quite hectic, and that is parasites. Parasites as per the normal definition, which is one animal living off another. Now many whites have observed that Jews are probably parasites on whites, that Jews live off of whites. And this is a valid observation, definitely a valid observation. But we're going to ignore these things and rather focus on animals and nature. And what I've done here is I've taken a video on parasites, removed some of the more benign parasites, and left you with the parasites that are pretty nasty. And these parasites, you'll see what they get up to. Now, interestingly enough, in this video, there's quite a bit of film footage from Africa. And it talks about things like the tsetse fly, these various flies that produce illnesses in Africa, and some pretty nasty illnesses, sleeping sickness, etc. So some of these parasites affect humans, and some of these parasites affect animals. And again, you're going to see a creature, in this case, not as cruel as in the sea, but you'll see creatures doing some pretty nasty things to other creatures. And it's quite painful and quite nasty. And the only thing that I can conclude from looking at these parasites and nature is that it boils down to efficiency. That at the end of the day, nature is very efficient. That if one animal can live off another animal, then it does so. And maybe the Jews being parasites of us has certain natural benefits for what it's worth. But I don't want to discuss the whites and Jews here. I'm just mentioning it as a passing set of comments. These are things we'll discuss in more detail more appropriately later. And also the reasons why I believe that we've ended up with these parasites. What is it that allows it to work, that this weird relationship between whites and Jews exists? And what are the solutions? If you've got tapeworms, I assure you, your doctor will want you to get rid of the tapeworms, as will you. And you'll see there are lice, etc., in here. And again, nobody tolerates lice. And if whites have got lice, if whites have got any of these illnesses, whites get rid of it. But we don't say that about the Jew. So that'll just give you a few thoughts there. But anyway, returning to nature, nature is clearly efficient. Nature is clearly very efficient at all costs. And some of the things that come out of here are bizarre. And there are even more bizarre parasitic relationships than the ones that I'm showing you in this video. But this is just to cover a couple of topics. And again, if this is the world that God created, you'll see the parasites that affect the blacks in Africa. And you'll see that in this world that God created, that the blacks are themselves subject to some pretty nasty things. And it may even include death. But that's the world that God created. That is how it actually is. That's how it functions. And if that's the world that God created and God thought it was good, then you need to ask yourself some questions. You know, what is the driving force here? My personal view, and this is just my personal view from my own thoughts, etc., is that it boils down to efficiency. That is the crux of life. And that if something can be done more efficiently, then nature does it. Without any concern about pain or suffering or anything like that. Pain and suffering do not concern nature. Pain and suffering have their purpose, but nature won't prevent pain and suffering. If the end result is positive, from nature's point of view, if it's efficient, it does it, man. It doesn't care less about it. In that sense, nature is cruel. And the organisms and the sophistication of the whole setup is just mind-boggling. It's amazing, really. And you'll see the different kinds of animals, the cookie-cutter shark and other parasites that just do the weirdest things. And yeah, so as far as I can see, nature doesn't waste any opportunities. If there are opportunities, nature lets it happen. Whatever works is acceptable to nature. Nature doesn't have any other criteria that it uses. Whatever's efficient and works, that's good enough for nature. Nature doesn't mess with it. Of course, this does lead one to the kind of thinking where you wonder where in the end this takes us. And one of the things I've wondered is whether competition and even warfare, whether these are natural things, whether even the nastiest things are actually quite natural, actually. But it is kind of scary if you just let it be, because you wonder where this ends up. I do think that one is probably forced by life that if you want to live, that you need to do whatever it is that you must do in order to live. And furthermore, anything goes, and if somebody uses a trick against you, and that trick is harmful to you, but you manage to survive it, you are forced to learn how to deal with all kinds of nasty tricks that are thrown your way, and that is how you are supposed to live. That if some human or animal finds some weak spot in your system, and they can exploit it, and by exploiting it, it works to your downfall and your destruction, that it is up to you to find the countermeasures to counter that. And that if you don't do it, you're going to be destroyed. But if you do it, then it's a new skill you've had to learn, even if it came at you and you were blindsided. That perhaps at the end of the day, there's no such thing as anything being sacred. That any trick goes. Now, of course, if it works that any trick goes for our enemies to use against us, then the question is, surely that means that any trick that we use for the downfall of our enemies is also equally valid. And I personally think that this is where these things lead to, that there's no such thing as certain levels of morality and honor when it comes to dealing with your enemies, especially with your biological enemies. And the key here is biological enemy. Things that are dangerous to the race as a whole. Things that can bring down our race as a biological people. That in fact, any method that they use to destroy us, we are quite free to use those methods against our enemies. And if we can find ways to destroy our biological enemies, our competing races that we are up against, that if we can find ways to defeat them and destroy them, that anything is good. Anything goes. That there is no limit to it, really. So if we come up with a trick and we blindside our enemies and we totally crush them into the ground, smash them, tear them apart, that actually, that's fine. It's quite fine. If it's good enough when they use any dirty, deceptive, low-down trick on us, that it's quite fine if we use any dirty, deceptive, low-down trick on them. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. That nature only rewards winners. Nature only rewards winners. And nature only rewards winners with life. And you only get that life for as long as you are able to remain a winner. But watch this video and then as you ponder all these things, ask yourself, where is the forgiveness of God? Where is God the referee? Where does God step in and save some poor creature from some other creature? God doesn't step in and God doesn't save or forgive anybody. As I've said before, if there is any forgiveness, if there is any good stuff that happens, it is either an accident or it's extremely rare. But otherwise, there's no forgiveness. Whereas I think that we have a lot of forgiveness towards our enemies that we really shouldn't have. And they don't deserve it either. So take a look at these parasites. Look at what nature does to humans, in this case blacks, and what nature does to even whites, and what nature does to other animals. And it's pretty nasty all round. And these things that I'm showing you are by no means comprehensive. If you actually go and study the topic of parasitism or any of these other things, you'll find thousands of examples, really weird, creepy ones. And in each case, pain and suffering, nature doesn't care. Nature only concerns itself with what wins. That which wins, that's fine.
Tsetse fly. This parasite is one that is feared by many in mid-continental Africa, and for good reason. They are active spreaders of disease. These obligate parasites survive by drinking the blood of vertebrate animals. They belong to the housefly family, and there are 23 species in total, and they live in open woody areas.
They've existed in this form on the planet for millions of years, and their method of sucking blood from their unsuspecting prey is pretty gross. They have tiny serrations inside their mouth that saw into the skin and then suck out the blood.
This parasite also transmits protozoan parasites, causing a potentially fatal disease called the sleeping sickness. If treatment is not sought, it is fatal. Some reports suggest that male tsetse flies attack humans while the females prefer large animals. Others believe that the fly bites humans accidentally and we're not their primary target. Radiation castration is being explored as an option to eradicate this parasite in African countries. Pea crab. This tiny critter calls the inside of oysters, clams, and mussels home. Called the pea crabs because of their size, these crustaceans are still being studied and not too much is known about them. What we do know is that they have a parasitic relationship with their hosts by feeding on the plankton that is part of the oysters, clams, and mussels diet. Usually things are fine with this situation, except when the pea crab feeds on the mucus strings that bring the food into the host's mouth. Once those are nibbled away, the host has no way of feeding and will die. In order to get inside the host, the pea crab rubs along the edge of the shellfish for hours until it finally opens and lets the crab in. Cookie cutter shark. Under normal circumstances, a name like cookie cutter shark would make you think of something small and harmless, but given our topic, rest assured it is anything but. It was named cookie cutter shark because of the cookie cutter shaped bite wounds it would leave behind on its prey. The teeth of the cookie cutter shark are unique and are short inside its coned snout. These sharks attach themselves to a tuna, stingray, or another shark, not excluding whales, and suction their lips onto them.
The shark then spins around. Think of a can opener, removing chunks of the prey's flesh. The result is a wound that looks like it's been cut out with a cookie cutter.
Oxpecker. This one is open to debate, so you can let me know what you think later. Oxpeckers are those sweet birds that are endemic to sub-Saharan Africa, and they gorge on insects. That doesn't sound too parasitic, does it? However, it's how and where they get their insects that places them on this list. Oxpeckers sit on the backs of large mammals and eat the parasites off of them. Where the contention about the parasitic nature of this animal comes in is that when you hear what we've just said, you'd say it was more of a symbiotic relationship than anything else. But here's the snag. The oxpecker's favorite food is blood, not the tick or botfly larvae it's removing. It only eats those because they're crammed with blood. If there are no more ticks to eat, the oxpecker will peck holes into the animal and feed directly on their blood, inviting more parasites to settle on the animal. So, Now you can see why we might class the oxpecker as a parasitic feeder. Tapeworms. Before you think this is not something you can get, think again. Anyone can get a tapeworm, and most people won't even be aware that they have it. The only signs might be anemia or a vitamin B12 deficiency, and maybe nausea. It's usually from eating undercooked or raw meat that people get tapeworms. Where tapeworms get scary is when someone accidentally consumes tapeworm eggs that were contracted through improper sanitation. The larval tapeworm hatch inside the body and then start roaming in search of a hiding place. Sometimes they latch onto muscle or brain tissue, causing an infection called cysticercosis. It's not common in the USA, but it's said to be one of the top 5 neglected parasitic infections that require attention. There is a myth that says placing a bowl of milk at your mouth will draw out the tapeworm. Suffice to say, it doesn't work, and you're far better seeking medical attention if you think you have a tapeworm. Head louse. Just the mention of lice has me scratching my head. And if you've ever had it before, you'll know how uncomfortable and gross it is and what a mission they are to get rid of. Guys are lucky. They can just shave their head, but it gets more complicated with longer hair. Here's the nitty-gritty. Lice have been around since forever, and evidence of head lice has been found on mummies. It's passed along from head to head, as lice cannot jump or fly from one head to another. Head lice are yellowish, whitish insects, about the same size as a sesame seed. Nits are their eggs, which you need to remove to stop the spread of lice. It's often said that lice like dirty hair, but that's just not true. They're not fussy and will head to clean, dirty, short, long, black, blonde, curly, or straight hair. This parasite feeds on the blood it suctions up from our scalp and can live for up to 30 days while laying 8 eggs a day. Around 2 million people at any given time are infected with lice in the UK. Vampire bats. Stories of vampires far preceded the discovery of vampire bats, which is why these bloodthirsty parasites have been aptly named after them. They were first described in 1810 and again in 1839 by Darwin. The connection between bat and vampire was made famous in 1897 when Bram Stoker's Dracula was released. With their lust for blood, vampire bats are parasites, and they also have parasites. Vampire bats shear hair and feathers away with their teeth and then use sharp incisors to pierce into the skin and suck the blood out from a wound. They have specialized grooves on their lips and tongues which help siphon up the blood.
Vampire bats have a special activator in their saliva called plasminogen, which prevents blood from clotting. They consume an ounce of blood at every meal, but during a 20 to 30 minute feeding session, they'll consume about half their body weight in blood.
1. Lampreys. It's a face only a mother could love. In fact, I'm not even sure that it has a face. I know that it at least has a mouth and teeth. Lots of teeth. Sea lampreys are parasitic fish found in the northern and western Atlantic Ocean. They're often misidentified as lamprey eels, but that is incorrect. They mostly feed off lake trout and other bony fish by using its disc-shaped suction cup mouth to latch onto the fish. Along with its rings of sharp, spiky teeth, the fish has no chance of escape. Once latched on, the lamprey uses its raspy tongue to lick away at the flesh of the fish to reach the blood and bodily fluids inside. If there was ever an award for the creepiest parasite, I think it goes to the lamprey.
Now, in this short video that you're going to see, you're going to see the response of a higher form of animal to a problem. In this case, dolphins. You get sharks that eat dolphins. But how do dolphins defend themselves? Well, it turns out that the way that dolphins fight against sharks is that they operate as a team. And dolphins, when they see a shark, they aggressively go after the shark. And so sharks avoid dolphins when dolphins are in groups. So this makes for quite an interesting turn of events, that an animal that could be a victim actually is so effective at defending itself that even an animal that is a killer an animal that is a carnivore, an animal that has to kill in order to eat, prefers to avoid the dolphin because of the dolphin's group behavior. So take a look at this, and also notice dolphins are highly intelligent. So this is a highly intelligent response to a threat, and it's a team response, it's a group response, and it works. So how do you defend yourself? Well, God doesn't forgive you, God doesn't help you. But if you defend yourself by developing your own tactics and methods and systems, that's how you stay safe. And I think that is the big takeaway from these dolphins, is that eventually you have to find a way to stay safe yourself. You have to do whatever is necessary in order to protect yourself. And if you can't do it alone by yourself, then others of your group must work together as a team. And then you can take on a predator that you would otherwise be afraid of. So it's just an example of nature allows you to live if you work hard enough to defend yourself. It's that simple. If you don't defend yourself, nobody's going to defend you.
It's a long-known fact that sharks prefer to avoid dolphins. They swim away quickly when they see them, especially grampus dolphins. Simultaneously, in the stomachs of some sharks, we found parts of dolphins. How can it be that such fearless predators are afraid of cute and playful dolphins? Let's take a look at this. Why are sharks afraid of dolphins? Dolphins are mammals that live in pods and are quite clever. It's well known that dolphins are not as harmless as they seem and know how to protect themselves. When they see an aggressive shark, they immediately attack it with the whole pod, not giving the shark any chances of survival. This is why sharks tend to avoid pods with many dolphins. Dolphins have some advantages over sharks due to the way their body is built. Their upper fin makes them very flexible. The combination of soft skin and a flexible skeleton structure allows them to be efficient in a fight. The vertical tail of the shark is flat and limits their up and down mobility, while dolphins have horizontal tails that allow them to have great mobility and a quick way to change directions in a fast attack. The heads of dolphins have very thick and very strong skin and act as a biological battering ram. Dolphins can be several meters under the shark and then quickly swim upwards and slam their snout into the shark's soft stomach. This will lead to serious internal traumas. When they have to defend themselves, they will protect each other from the shark's attack with their massive snouts that they use to hit the gills of the shark. A well-placed hit can cause enough damage to kill the shark. Therefore, they can surround a shark and hit her gills first before the actual attack on the stomach. In a way, they just frighten the shark until it swims away itself. Sharks are predators who swim alone, while dolphins travel in groups, so-called pods. Every time a member of the group is in danger, the rest will come to help them. There are even known cases where dolphins saved humans from sharks. There just needs to be two or three dolphins, and the shark will prefer to stay away instead of clashing with them. Sharks like to attack targets that are smaller than them, for example, small dolphin babies. When they decide to attack a baby dolphin, they usually can't escape an attack by a pod full of angry dolphins. The biggest advantage of the dolphins, however, is their intelligence. By using echolocation, they can move fast in the water in order to avoid or to attack sharks. A shark's biggest chance of killing a dolphin is when the shark is hidden away from their sight, since they are silent predators. But when the first try is unsuccessful, the dolphin can easily swim away or regroup to fight together with the rest of his pod. Additionally, dolphins are incredibly fast. They can swim faster than the majority of sharks, making them an elusive food that's not worth the effort. According to the data provided by organizations supporting whales and dolphins, one-third of dolphins living in the waters off Sarasota, Florida, have scars from incidents with sharks. That's why in some parts of the world, sharks are considered to be the biggest threat to dolphins. However, there is one more dolphin species that scared white sharks. It's the killer whale, the biggest representative of dolphins, and they hunt for white sharks when they don't have enough food. They use their massive and strong tails to flip the sharks over and make them immobile. This is why white sharks prefer to flee from killer whales immediately, as they are especially interested in eating their liver. With extreme precision, they take out the shark's liver and throw away the rest of the body. No wonder sharks are afraid of them. What do you think? Would sharks be afraid of dolphins if they wouldn't swim in pods? If you liked the video, give it a like and subscribe to our channel so you won't miss anything interesting. We'll see you later.
So now that we've taken this sojourn through a bit of nature and just had a look at nature and how animals in nature deal with each other, I think you can appreciate that nature is pretty ruthless. And there is a quote from Hitler that nature is cruel. And the quote is, "I do not see why man should not be just as cruel as nature." I don't know where exactly this quote comes from, but it's attributed to Hitler. And of course, there are also many quotes of Hitler where people make up things about Hitler. But if he said that, that wouldn't surprise me, because Hitler had a good, sound understanding of life and science, and he'd done lots and lots of reading in his life. One quote that is definitely from Hitler is that life doesn't forgive weakness. And you can go and look through nature, man. Go and look through nature. There's no such thing as forgiveness. Life does not forgive weakness. There is also a quote from Hitler where he says, "He who wishes to live, let him fight." All of these quotes from Hitler are completely in agreement with nature. There is absolutely nothing wrong in what he's saying. Hitler wasn't just a politician. Hitler was much, much deeper than that. Hitler had a far deeper understanding of life. And when they created their system and their political party and they set out to save Germany, all they were doing was trying to save themselves. All they were trying to do was to understand life, what is the truth, and how should you move forward. Among the driving forces they had was various philosophical writings like that of Nietzsche, but a lot of thought went into what they were doing, why they were doing it, and what should you be doing. Hitler is probably the most scientific politician who ever lived, and all he tried to do was to tell his people the truth, tell them about reality, say to them, this is the way the world is, this is how life is, and we need to work in accordance with life the way it is. Not about pretending things that aren't so, but merely accepting things the way they are. There is a nice term that whites have always used when looking at nature, nice European term, and they looked at nature and they spoke about natural law. Natural law is merely looking at things the way they are. You do not try to change it, but you try to understand it and you try to see what is the natural way that things are dealt with. And then you accept those facts and you move on. And whites, until the last century maybe, whites until the last century were quite adept at accepting life and things the way they are, accepting the harshness of life and reality, and living with it. And whites themselves are the product of people who lived through unbelievable climate change and really, really nasty natural weather. We ourselves are survivors of a very, very cruel world. Our ancestors survived the worst things that life could throw at them, and they themselves had to just try and find ways to live. And they did. And they survived situations that are far worse than anything that we face today. What we face today is nothing compared to the harshness that they faced. And for them, it was a case, just like with the ibex, was a case of you make a mistake and you're dead. Same as any animal that's hunted. If you make a mistake, you're dead. And in that sense, thinking the way Hitler thinks is actually not only scientific, it's natural and much more in accordance with nature than anything else. If you want to pretend things that are not so, then it is you that are out of step with nature. If you try to make life something that it isn't, and try to force values on people that have no basis in reality, maybe you are the one that's out of step with the world. And I actually will argue that the success of white people is based on our ability to work with nature and to even control nature. We can do what no other animal can do. Virtually no animal can control nature the way we can. This is a very unique thing that we've evolved. We are able to control nature and even bend nature to our will in a way that no other animal or human species can do. It is totally unique to our race. And how it can be that we don't look on ourselves as being amazing and our achievements as being great, which they are. They're truly incredibly great. We've adopted so many junk ideas where we just accept, oh no, we're at fault. We're at fault. Everything else is perfect, but we're at fault. No, if we were at fault, we would not be alive. If our forefathers couldn't handle the unbelievable harshness of life in the past, we would not be here. We would be dead. And the fact that we can do the things that we do, which are totally unique, our science and technology, it's totally unique. Nobody can match us. And yet we don't even appreciate that side of ourselves. It's absolutely horrific, the kind of twisted thinking that we've accepted for ourselves. But nature shows how things really work. And we used to work much more in line with nature. And I would argue that the only way forward really is to work with nature and also to let nature do its task. Nature also sets out to kill people who are our biological competitors, our enemies, and we go and we save them. And I think we're making huge mistakes in that regard. That if we left nature to do its own work, a lot of things would work out for us perfectly. Absolutely perfectly. So those are some thoughts on nature. And nature, to recap, nature does not forgive. Of course, that doesn't mean we can't forgive each other, but we need to also be careful when and how we apply it. I do believe that we should forgive certain things, but we must make our rules realistic, etc. And we must know that some of these things, if we apply them to ourselves, we're only doing it because we want a group benefit for our people. So if we forgive some of our people. but maybe we should not forgive everybody. And we definitely should not have these things as external options where we run around forgiving everybody in the world. Maybe there are people that we shouldn't be forgiving. The second lesson is nature does not waste. Nature loves efficiency. And once you understand our science and technology, you'll see that we ourselves are creatures of efficiency. Our ability to bend nature is a topic I'd like to get back to, because it is an example of how well we grasp nature. We would not be successful with our technology and science at all if we were not able to work within the framework of nature. And the fact that others cannot do it shows a deficiency on their part. It shows that we can do things that are impossible for others to do. Absolutely impossible. We might actually be expecting things of others that they are physically and mentally incapable of doing. And yet we think among ourselves that, oh, this is just normal. It's just normal. Everybody can do it. I can do it. Therefore, somebody living in the Congo can do it. No, that's not true. And I've not even got to the issue of our history and what we learned in the past and how old we are and the things that we've known and developed. So lesson number 3 from nature. Losers experience pain and are on the receiving end of cruelty. The winner only gets a full stomach for his intense efforts. And in nature, there are winners and losers. And the loser might die. And that's how nature works. And my final argument regarding nature is that parasitism may be the norm. That parasites are simply a lower form of existence. That it is only whites. It is only whites who've managed to get to the point where they can produce more than they need. We are the only animal in nature that can do that. And that includes other human species. They too, all of them, without exception, are parasites. It is only certain types of non-whites like the Japanese who are on a similar level as us. But other than that, parasitism is a lower form of evolution, it's a lower form of life, and it's the norm across all species. It is only us who have managed to rise above that kind of thing. But all this emotional nonsense that we believe and listen to, I don't think that is wise. I really think we need to be much more logical in our approach to life. We really must be, because if we look around at our failures, all of our failures, you'll see that all of the things that have gone wrong for us relate back to things like forgiveness, helping others who later will turn on you, etc., etc. So I think that there are non-logical things that we've done, where we've accepted emotional arguments. Oh, we must help these people. Those people are going to starve over there. Then you help those people who starve, and later they become your enemy and they want to kill you. Those are the kinds of things that have happened to us. We should think about these things. Do we really want to assist certain kinds of people? Is it wise to engage in these types of actions? Whereas Christianity gives you this blanket order. Oh, you must help everybody, you must save everybody, save everybody who's suffering. That's crazy, man. That's crazy stuff. And it should show you that if you save these other humans, they can turn on you, man. A dog is more loyal than another human. At least the dog won't turn on you. But other humans will. And finally, Hitler, in a proper scientific way, saw whites as an organism. Professor Quigley raises this as well, and I want to get back to Quigley and talk about Quigley in detail. Quigley himself talks about the different ways that you can view humans. You can either view them as just groups, or you can view them as organisms. And he stated that Hitler viewed groups of people as organisms. Now, if you view your group as an organism, then it's a whole different ballgame. It means that the group has to stick together, and the group must look at group survival and group benefits. And to quote a website like Occidental Dissent, then you need to talk about in-group rules, in-group preferences versus out-group rules and out-group preferences. In other words, you have rules for inside your group, but you have separate rules for outside your group. You do not go and take the whole world and give the whole world the same privileges that you give people inside your group. Instead, you've got a set of preferences and rules for inside your group and a set of rules for people outside your group. The Jews themselves function like this. In fact, everybody functions like this. It is only whites that have allowed everybody in. But I just want to get some of these ideas across to you. And a very important idea is the idea of whites as a biological entity. If you view whites as a biological entity, which we are, then that opens a lot of doors. And then you can start seeing the future and planning the future. And our view should be that our organism is going to survive. And our organism could, in theory, survive forever. But that's a discussion for another day. So I hope this gives you a little bit of a thought about nature and life. And what is it really like? What is this world that God created? What is it really like? And aren't we very much getting out of touch with it? To our own detriment, this is what we need to be thinking about. And just by following the laws of nature, I'm convinced that lots and lots of things will work out so much better for us as a group, simply by following the laws of nature. Nature will help us in so many ways, and nature tries constantly to kill certain of our biological enemies, and we should let that take place. We shouldn't interfere with nature. Nature sometimes benefits you in a lovely way. It's like being on a bicycle and you cycle uphill and you find the going is tough. And then there are times when you are going on the downhill slope and gravity is assisting you, and suddenly you find you need hardly any effort and nature's helping you. That is how nature is. Sometimes it's an uphill battle, and sometimes nature all by itself is coming to solve a problem for us, and we don't let it. Let those who court starvation, leave them to die. Why do we save people when it should be obvious that when you save them, they are thankless and they will at the first opportunity turn against you? This, I think, is one of our biggest errors. But there are many other conclusions one can draw as well. So I hope this gives you some food for thought. Think about nature. Think about the world that God created. And think about us. And see where that takes you. And my view is that nature actually favors us. That everything we've done actually is quite in accordance with nature. But I'll return to some of these topics in more detail later. But I just want to round up by saying that I think one should contrast the emotional, wishful thinking nature of scriptures versus the logical, realistic nature of the way the world really is. And I really think that whites do not need these emotional, wishful thinking kinds of approach to life. If you understand our history and everything we've done, we have progressed way, way, way beyond this. Even hundreds of years ago, we were already way beyond this. We must stop looking towards wishful thinking nonsense, emotional nonsense, when in fact we ourselves are largely logical and disciplined, and we fit in with nature, which is itself logical. Logical to the extreme. Logical to the extreme where death and torture and pain does not affect nature's outcome. Nature simply operates on reality and winners. And in that world, with those rules, we would come out number one all the time. So why on earth we settle for other junk thinking, I just don't know. I think we are just doing ourselves a massive disservice by doing that. We have demonstrated our ability to survive more than anybody else on the planet. We've solved problems that nobody's even conceived of solving. So why we think we need emotional, wishful thinking rubbish, when in fact we've shown clearly to the core that logic, discipline, reality works for us. I would go so far as to say that the white man is the god of reality. The white man can fit in with any kind of cruelty that nature can offer. The white man can fit in with it and function with it and be at one with it, and he'll be fine. He is not disadvantaged by reality. In fact, he can tap into reality in a way that nobody else can. And why we don't allow this to work to the benefit of us is insane. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.